Hello everyone, welcome to today's seminar here in the room, and have around 10 people on Zoom. So let us introduce our speaker. We have Shango Lu from the University of Warwick. He earned his Bachelor of Science from Beijing and then Diplom Physica from Hamburg. Then he completed a PhD at Heidelberg on heavy ion physics, working on data analysis in the ALICE experiment at CERN. Then he moved to Oxford as a PDRI, postdoc research assistant, starting to work on neutrino physics. He was awarded the Ernest Rutherford Fellowship. Then he joined Warwick in 2021, and his current major project includes Juno and the Warwick TPC platform. So,
thank you, everyone. Hello, good morning, and hello to people on Zoom. So, I'm glad to tell you about the status and the first research result from the German Underground Neutrino Observatory. Before we talk about Juno, perhaps it's useful to review what's neutrino. First of all, in the standard model, neutrino is quite boring, isn't it? It has no electric charge and it has no mass. So the first question is, how do we actually know there are different neutrinos? Six of them in total. So I call them phaseless neutrinos, actually. But you know, when neutrinos interact, actually it can produce charged particles, and then different species produce different charged leptons, and thereby we have the characteristic of flavor assigned to the neutrinos. And so everything becomes a bit familiar and normal in standard model. However, nature is different slightly. So we know the neutrinos have some mass, and that actually gives us another way to recognize the neutrinos. But are they the same as the flavor way to see the neutrinos? This is the problem about neutrino identification, so to say. So that in the standard model, we have the flavor eigenstate. And then we also have now the mass eigenstate. And in fact, they are connected by the so-called PMNS matrix. Let's not go into this detail yet, but recognize that neutrinos have masses. So three of them, three different masses. What does it mean? So one has to be the smallest, of course, and then the other has to be large. Then what is the remaining one? The remaining one really depends. If it's close to a small one, then we actually have the so-called normal ordering. And if the middle one is actually close to a large one, we have the inverted ordering. So from this narrative, we only recognize that the mass ordering, or the so-called mass hierarchy problem, is in fact a problem when there are more than two masses. This is very interesting. What's more interesting is that now we have the mass gaps and also the eigenstate mixing. Then it actually produces neutrino oscillations. This is a very blank statement, blank as this slide. But in fact, we can understand this by a down-to-earth analogy. So, for example, in a magnetic field, spin up and spin down have different energy, and then we have this energy gap, and also the up and down state combined in different ways to produce the x and y state. So as time goes on, the x and y states actually oscillate. This is the same thing mathematically as our neutrino oscillation. So we see here the neutrinos have the mass gaps and also the mixing EMS, and eventually we see the flavor either survive or appear. So these are the same probabilities as in the spin rotation case. But now the phase is a function of the mass gap dot m squared, and there's a function of the L over D, the baseline, and the neutrino energy. So now, by far, we haven't really talked about specifics about the mass gap and PMS. We'll deal with it later. What is more important at the moment is to ask the question whether all these three flavors participate in oscillation or not, two or three flavors. This is an important question, because if we have just two flavors, then the constraint or the oscillation probability is so strong that there's no difference between machine oscillation and anti-machine oscillation. However, when we have three-frame oscillations, this additional degree of freedom actually can allow the oscillation pattern to be different between machines and anti-machines, and thereby we could potentially measure the so-called CP violation in the atomic sector. So coming to some specifics about the mass, we know three different states, so two independent mass gaps. And the big one is 30 times larger than the smaller one. And now, by definition, the smaller one is always the 2 minus 1, and therefore the delta m squared is always positive. Then we ask the only possibility to arrange the third state, either is further beyond the 2, which is the normal hierarchy, or below the first, that is its inverted ordering tier. Mass ordering or mass hierarchy is interchangeable in my narrative here. Let's look into the PMLS matrix. It's a bit complicated, but in fact, we can dissect it in the following way. So the 1-2 is the mixing between the mass 1 and the mass 2 state, and 2-3 is about the mu tau state. Then the theta 1-3 is very interesting, because if theta 1-3 is 0, then effectively you have a 2 flavor mixing. And by the discussion before, you guys said in such a case, we won't be able to look at CP violation. And luckily, this delta CP is not zero, and the delta CP could be in principle be studied. So what is the open question in machine oscillation? First of all, we won't be able to measure oscillating mass with machine oscillations. Therefore, if you want to know about the machine masses, we can only know about the gaps like the delta M squared. And we also want to know more how they mix together, namely the mixing parameters needs to be better determined. So with all these interesting physical topics, what can we do experiments? So we have different additional sources. And here is a summary as a function of additional energy. You see the MEV and the GEV here. So around this region, we have solar neutrinos, geo neutrinos, atmospheric neutrinos, and of course, our accelerated neutrinos also in the GEV regime. If we are concerned with neutrino oscillations, then we will probably first look at solar neutrinos, radiated neutrinos, and accelerator and atmospheric neutrinos. A very interesting fact is that for the solar neutrinos, they are all neutrinos of the electron flavor, and in contrast, the radiated one is electron anti-neutrinos. And as long as oscillation is concerned for the accelerator neutrinos and atmospheric neutrinos, we care about the muon flavor. So just remind ourselves that there are only two independent delta m squares, and the oscillation phase is proportional to delta m squared scaled by L over E. So what happens if we put all the experiments in a diagram with the energy E and the baseline L? So here we have the MEV and the GEV regime, and the 1 kilometer baseline, 1,000 kilometer baseline. So we see actually we have one cluster here for the reactor experiments, and the last cluster of the accelerator and atmospheric experiment. Now the two things looking in the same perspective, because they're on the same line of L over E. Therefore, they're actually popping the same delta M square, which is the last one, the large one, because the delta M square is large. Therefore, the L over E just need to be small to show the oscillation and is fast oscillation. Now, still with the reactor neutrinos, we can actually extend the baseline, and we see another cluster here. And it's on a different line of the L over E, and in fact, it's sensitive to the small delta M squared. And because the delta M squared is small, it takes more time or long distance to see the oscillation, therefore it is a slow oscillation. So also you see all these clusters have their relative strength in measuring all the parameters. here this 1-3, here this 2-3, and delta CP, and also here this 1-2, and delta M squared of all mass shadows. So this is the end of the story, isn't it? Is there anything more? So what you see here is the survival probability of the reactor anti-neutrinos as a function of the baseline. Kalman did the pioneering measurement using oscillating neutrinos to measure the slow oscillation, the red curve. It's really pioneering. It is the first time that we actually measure these so-called solar missing parameters with reactors. But you can see because they are pioneering, they didn't really sit at the best location. And Juno, with all this hindsight, is built and there's no oscillation maximum here. Therefore, it's extremely sensitive to this solar missing parameter. And today's focus will be Juno's measurement of this solar missing parameters and the Juno performance that this first result is based on. Of course, Juno is built for more. If you look more closely, now we can focus on the blue line. It is small oscillation, maybe the fast one, sitting on the slow one. This is very interesting because, in fact, if you look at how the flavor evolved between the electron flavor and the muon and count flavor, you see something like that. So pure electron flavor, and then gradually maximally towards maximum conversion to the muon flavor and the tau flavor. So this is at the Juno baseline. Once the neutrinos pass the Juno baseline, you actually see following the large oscillation, it comes back and forth. The small wiggles still stays. This is important because this small wiggle actually is sensitive to the mass ordering. So it depends on whether it's normal ordering or inverted ordering. We have a shift. And Juno is very ambitious. We try to measure neutrino mass ordering by measuring the oscillation spectrum. So first thing first, why do we want to measure neutrino mass ordering in the first place? Well, I haven't seen my GT colleague here, but I think it is a fair statement that even if you know about neutrino mass ordering, it will be extremely difficult to measure delta CP. You can imagine a scenario that nature is is normal ordering, but then one experiment actually measured delta CP in this big area, in this phase, but the other experiment measured delta CP in a totally different time space. And not to mention that at the moment, we don't know which order it is. On the other hand, in order to tell whether the neutrinos is Mara or Dirac, we could perform the search for neutrinos propagation. What happens if we are already sensitive to the mass in this region, but still haven't found anything? Then the interpretation really depends on the mass ordering. If it's inverted ordering, fine, it means there's no neutrinos propagate decay, and therefore neutrinos are Dirac particles. But if fortunately or unfortunately it is normal ordering, then it means that we just have to work much harder to try to look for neutrinos propagate decay. So mass ordering matters or not to our strategic experiment plan as well. So it also influences the sum of the neutrino mass in cosmology, and it is also plays a part in the neutrino flavor evolution in supernova neutrinos. So where's Juno? Juno is in the south part of China. Yeah. If you zoom in, you will see that is 52.5 kilometers away from two nuclear power plants, the Langjiang nuclear power plant and also the Taishan power plant. And You can look at some names here. Hong Kong is here, and Guangzhou is here. And this is my hometown. So this whole area is the so-called Guangdong Hong Kong Macau Greater Bay Area, one of the powerhouses of the Chinese economy. The general collaboration has more than 700 participants, and we have a very strong team in Europe, for example. And the UK involved started in officially in 2022, actually personally much earlier than that. It's a vibrant collaboration. You see our collaborators have the time to help the local farmers, but just enough time to cut these small patches, not whole fields. And we try to make moon cake. This is a special type of it. It's the ICC coating moon cake. What's the issues? So Juno is an underground lab. So this is the ground. Yeah. 500 meters deep, we have experimental hall. Because it is in a huge area, in fact, we have about 700 rocks overburden. It looks like this from the sky. And here is the entrance of ground to the lab. And also, there's another entrance. So either we take the slope tunnel through 1,300 meters in this very interesting chord, or actually take the lift down 600 meters from the vertical shaft. What you see here now is the general detector. The biggest structure is the cylindrical water tank. It has a diameter 43.5 meters and a height 44 meters. And in fact, it is optically separated in two regions. The outer one is the water strength of detector with 35 kilotons of water. So then the inner part, I will talk more about it later, is the 5 kiloton water buffer below the Tyvek. So the Tyvek actually sits on the stainless steel structure. So this is the whole stainless steel structure. I'm going to sit on it. And this structure actually holds some veto PMTs, 2,000 of them, looking outwards into the water channel detector. And also some large PMTs looking inwards towards the inner structure and also with small PMTs. So in total, we have about 18,000 large PMTs and about 26,000 small PMTs. In total, they cover 78% of the area. So this optical coverage is a scary number because 78% means that the holding structure, the stainless steel structure, only can have mechanical precision better than 3 millimeters. If things get worse, there's no way to fit them together. It will be a disaster, but we actually manage it. So continue to peel the onion, we can see the innermost part is the acrylic vessel. It has a diameter of 35.4 meters, and inside it holds 20 kilotons nuclear scintillator. The scintillator's light emission peak is around 430 nanometer. It is the white blue like this. So everything is just on paper, right? Now let's look at some photo. So here, what we see is the stainless steel structure, and beneath it is the part of the acrylic vessel. So a zoom in, because those are the workers. Yeah. And now you can see actually the little PMTs on the stainless steel structure. And actually, look closer, you can see the back of the large PMTs really inside. So now, if you look at here, this is a vessel, and then this is a supporting rod for the stainless steel structure. And you can see the large PMTs and also small PMTs. And this buffer area is actually quite large. And it has a depth of 5 meters. So the Juno project first got approved in China in 2013, and then in 2014 with Italy and so on and so forth. And the civil construction started in 2015. We have a great challenge to tackle because of the underground water. And then later, towards the decade, we were hit by COVID. And eventually, the civil construction was finished in 2022. And then we started the detector installation. And that's how it was done. About 3 years effort in 30 seconds. So it's done just like that. If you look at the status, the detectors are happening like this in 2022, then 2023, 2024, and this is right before everything is finished. And here is a comparison. When we first touch down onto the base, it looks like Star Wars Death Star, doesn't it? So the background music. And here, you see the happy faces of everyone. But this is not done yet. We need to clean the vessel with our arm. And actually, we use a high pressure water gun spray. It's mesmerizing, isn't it? We can look at it all day. But let's continue. After it's done, we can see the vessels like this. All these five spots are actually the joints from the supporting rod from the stainless steel structure. And through the vessel, you can see behind actually all those PMTs. So once this is done, you can actually fill the whole detector and also the inside of the acrylic vessel with water, pure water. And this was started in December 2004. After 2 months, it's done. It looks like this. So from February 2025, we start to replace the water in the synthetic detector with liquid synthetic. It's a very delicate process. Therefore, it took 6 months to finish. But then when it's finished, we move on quickly. So in August 2025, once the liquid synthetic finish, filling is finished, we start the castration campaign, and on the 26th of August, we start this completion. You can see the initial days when the random radon concentration is high and gradually it decays out. After some days, we start to collect physical quality data, and by the time of the beginning of November, we have collected 69 calendar days of data. And this corresponds to 59.1. This is quality database. But actually, during the calibration campaign before the this data starting, we actually have already received regular signals, and that is displayed for one of the golden days. Now we talk about the acetylation characteristic data, but basically, you would first see a prompt positron signal. And then nearby, you also see a delayed neutron signal. So spatial displacement is about 1 meter or less. And then the temp is a few hundred microns. So one of the key performance index is the attenuation length, both for the liquid scintillator and also for the water. Because for the center detector, the attenuation length actually is critical to tell us how much the life yield we receive. And also remember our acrylic vessel has a radius of about 18 meters. So if the attenuation length is too low, it means that the photon might not even get to the PMTs. Or part of them get to it, or not. So depends on where the event is. There could be an uniformity of the detection response. So we try to achieve a very long attenuation length. So for the central detector, the design goal is 20 meters. And we have actually achieved on average 20.6 meters at the relevant wavelength. And for the water chemical detector, the design goal is 40 meters attenuation length. But with ultra pure water, actually, we have achieved 70 meters. The detector is big, and then we actually are looking at the low energy range. Therefore, radio purity is important. We have, however, internal radioactivities from two major sources. First of all, it's a cosmogenic spallation. When muons come into the detector and interact, actually it can produce all this spallation products. On the other hand, the material itself could contain naturally occurring uranium, thorium, and so on and so forth. All this decay eventually to alpha betas. On the one hand, they are contamination, of course. On the other hand, actually they provide us an ideal inner calibration source for alpha, for example. And specifically, if you look at this decay chain, bipolar, so-called bipolar 2 and 4, here, so bismuth and also thorium decays to a beta, is a pump signal, and then alpha decay signal. This has some very nice characteristic coincidence, and that we can identify them easily, they will be very helpful. So by measuring the bipole, we actually have an idea how the radioactivities get inside the detector and also dies out. So by the time during the commission, we actually measure all this radioactivity inside the CD and also the water treatment of the detector. We see that all these contaminations either is already achieved the design level or even better than the design. The effort is actually tremendous. An analogy would be to achieve all this is equivalent to have less than 10 milligrams of dust in the whole ton of fluid because it's many orders of magnitude control. So for general, the energy resolution is very important, therefore, we actually need to calibrate it very well. This is our CD, and we can actually deploy the source along the z-axis, and also we can put the source, radioactive source, calibration source, on a smooth plane here, all around the vessel. So, this is the exact deployment plan. So, we have the cesium-137 mechanism, 54, aluminium 58, potassium 40, and cobalt 60. They all have different gammas and different energies. They are all deployed along the z-axis. And we also have a lithium carbon source that gives us the strong gamma signal and also the dynamic neutron capture gamma signals. And they are deployed along the z-axis and also on this COS system. And so, with all this energy Jim mapped out, we actually can understand the non-linearity of the energy response in our different. And in fact, our understanding is better than 1%. If you look at our intrinsic energy compared to the expected one, we have achieved an understanding of the energy scale better than 0.5%. And if you look at this at the different location of the radius, namely when the event happens at different radius, then we see actually they don't wear it that much. It's a good indication of the uniformity of the detector. And of course, when things happen near the boundary of the acrylic vessel, this becomes very difficult to come to this nature. So inside bulk of the fiducial volume, actually the uniformity is guaranteed. So coming to the energy calibration, the eventual assessment study, we use the boronium upper source and look at the energy resolution, it's already better than 3%. However, if we look at all this gamma calibration source for the germanium, which is close to 1 MeV, the resolution is 3.4%. You may say, okay, it's good enough, but in fact, it's still worse than the expectation of 3.1%. But remember that it's only 60 days of data, and we are still trying to improve the conjunction and with better methods and also better energy conjunction. So the timing of the event is very useful for two reasons. First is to reject backgrounds, and also the information is used in the spatial construction, namely the vertex construction. So what you can see in this slide is that the event level residual time, namely the actual measured time compared to the expected time for the event, looks like this for the Hamamatsu PMT and also the Chinese PMT. For both of them, you see the prompt arrival peak, and also the data is well described by the model. So this is very important because it means that we understand the time response of our PMTs. And this is consistent with the design, and it's not a limiting fact. So all this performance is sufficient for background video and also for the vertex reconstruction. So the spatial reconstruction is that we use the time information and also potentially with the energy information to reconstruct where it's happened inside this bulk of singularity. So we put the germanium source around the z-axis and then reconstruct the z component of the vertex. And we can see the bias is within 10 centimeters. This is good, and the deviation is largest at the boundary. And on the other hand, the resolution of this reconstruction is within 10 to 20 centimeters. So you see, actually, in both cases, the boundary effect is very strong. On the one hand, the light connection is not uniform and then sometimes it's messed. And also, when you're close to the boundary, the total reflection actually happens and then change the optical property very much. Therefore, the boundary is always a difficult region. And here we have not many information to prepare for this plot. First of all, it shows the event rate at the outermost 10 centimeter inside a acrylic vessel. So what you see is the reconstructed position of the event. And you see all these bright spots. They are actually the external radio activity coming from the joint from supporting node. So we see that in the outer part of a acrylic vessel, actually it's regulated because of the external radioactivity. Reason one. Reason two is that in all this region, the optical performance is very bad. And for this region, we actually need to cut out the very outer part of the acrylic vessel. The microsynchronous mode. But overall, the vertex reconstruction is sufficient for event selection, like to define the fiducial volume. And also, if you want to correct for any volume banks or radio banks, non uniformity, then the vertex reconstruction will be used. Now, let's look at the physical event. What happens if an anti-electron neutrino comes in inside the detector? So we'll be looking at so-called inverse beta decay. It's a reaction that happens on hydrogen or on carbon because the energy is more hot. And first of all, we have the position produced and that we align it with the neutron. So this bunch of energies called bond energy is highly correlated for the neutron energy itself. On the other hand, the neutron do some random walk and then slow down and then capture. The neutron capture has a very nice signature. First of all, the energy is about 2.2 MeV. So if we relate the bond energy and then the capture energy, then we see actually we can identify the secret event away from the background. On the other hand, the actual capture time is about, the mean capture time is 200 microseconds, and we can comfortably select this time window. And also the distance between form and then the next signal is quite small. Actually, it can go up only to 1 meter. So we can also define this spatial restriction. So all in all, for IDE, we have the triple coincidence selection. Of course, we have to worry about the background. What kinds of background do we have? We have the internal radioactivity that I just mentioned before. And here specifically, the lithium helium one is very dangerous. It's caused by muon bombardment or the liquid scintillator cosmogenic expansion. However, it will decay in beta and also neutron. It provides actually the very fake IBD coincidence. And we have the natural radioactivity we just mentioned. And in addition, we have the external background coming from the world geoneutrinos and world reactors, and also from geoneutrinos from those uranium thorium in the cross element. So in order to select the event, as I mentioned before, we first need to define the fiducial loading, cut away the outermost layer. This is to guarantee that we don't have the contamination coming from outside, but also to guarantee that the eventual performance is best. On the other hand, we reject occasional PMT bad signatures, and also very importantly to remove anything related to an incoming muon inside the detector. And we also require that we have exact two triggers that is expected for the IBD. And after that, we perform finally the triple coincidence selection. So the muon is so important because if we veto them or if related activity, we will have the internal radioactivity contamination. So let's first have a look how it is done. In the WCD, it is by the strength of light, and in fact, we see 9 hertz of muons in this detector. And it can also detect in the CD by the energy signature and the spatial extension of it. So we have the 5 gates, 5 hertz for the muon registered in the CD. And if we compare the triggers or signatures of the muon in the CD and WCD, we actually can determine the detecting efficiency for the muons, and it's almost 100%, so it's very good. If we look at the distribution of all these incoming muons, we see most of them coming from above, because we are an underground laboratory, this is expected. And here we see the data, and Montel agrees very well for the theta, azimuth, the polar distribution, and also the azimuth distribution. This is not a trivial plot because it really depends the overburden and the above wall structure in the different azimuth direction. If you remember from this bird's eye view, we have actually a huge area. The data or the color consistency actually tells us we have modeled all this structure precisely so that the flux, normalization, and shape are consistent between data and color. So in the end, we have all these candidate numbers. Let's go through them one by one. First of all, for the non-oscillated spectrum, we expect a certain signal rate, and the major difficulty or dominating systematics is how we count the number of photons in the liquid scintillator. So it contributes about 1% in systematics, and also the red flux currently is constrained by the release diabetic detector data. So this reference spectrum has 1.2% systematic error. And of course, we have residual reactor specific systematics that is related to Tyson, to the downtown nuclear power plant. And these are all the respective systematics. In total, over this 60 days of free accessibility day, we have about 2,400 events, so on average 60, so sorry, 40 candidates per day. And if we look at the predicted background, in total it's about six background per day. The most important background is the lithium ion, the cosmogenic spallation or contamination. If we look at the signal to background ratio, it's about 8. In fact, this is already a very good number because if we consider how shallow the experiment is. On the other hand, the second largest background comes from the geodetic signal, and even though it's a background, but in fact, it's a very interesting physical signature. So we have to correct all these events for efficiency, and the major reduction of efficiency comes from the change of the free digital volume. And it also contributes to the largest systematics, and it's about 1.6%. The overall efficiency is about 70%. When we have subtracted all the background, and then we should really be seeing the signal. And what happens if we look at it day by day? This is a very interesting observation because we have the data. On the other hand, actually, it's highly consistent with the predictions. The story is like that. Around 2015, September, there was a typhoon hitting the area, and this is one of the strongest typhoons in the area in the past few decades. And one of the reactor core is turned off, therefore you directly see immediate drop in the number of events. And then when it's die off, actually we turn on the other core. And at this point in October, we turn on another core. So basically, we see a very dynamic number of candidates increase here. And our data actually reflects this trend precisely. Effectively, this plot shows us that we have achieved reactor real-time monitoring at a distance of 50 kilometers. And of course, it really depends on the core power. Now, after all the cooking, it's time to serve the dish. What you see here is the spectrum of our event candidate as a function of the pumped energy. The dots are the data, and the big structure is the expected spectrum, the oscillation. So immediately you see the oscillation effect is very strong. And with all the predicted background, and this is the geological background, and these are all the others, we have very high signal component. And the overall spectrum with the fitted oscillation parameter is in the red. So when we compare the oscillation spectrum with the non-oscillated spectrum, we see that distortion is driven by solar mixing parameters. And the background is under control. And all this observation has been done in three independent analysis groups. We have all the different machineries for selection, reconstruction, background estimation, response, and fitting all different in this free analysis group, and then they all achieve consistency. If we look at the soil mixing parameters, the correlation, and comparison with other previous measures, we have interesting observations. First of all, in terms of single experiment sensitivity, our general result has error bar that is 1.6 times smaller than the previous best one. And our result is a significant improvement, but standing on the shoulder of giants, of course, is better than the previous 5 decades of later genome measurement. And we only use 60 days of data. If we look at the single parameters and their errors, we see that both parameters are already entering the percent level accuracy. What is more interesting to my taste is that this step m squared to 1 actually has two groups. Our result is consistent with other reactor oscillation experiments. However, the same quantities can be measured by experiment using the neutrinos from the sun, and then they consistently deviate from the one from the reactors. So is there something interesting going on? We don't know. It's good to think about it. So at this moment, we are transiting to a precision era of solar mixing parameter measurement. In fact, we have demonstrated that sub-percent level measurement is possible as long as we have a much larger detector and also high enough statistics. So beyond the first measurement, we expect to measure the solar mixing parameters and also the delta M squared 3-1 to enter the sub-percent level accuracy after 100 days of data taking. And for the mass ordering sensitivity, suppose we have normal ordering, then we would reach 3 sigma after 7.1 years. And if it is inverted ordering, then the same exposure actually would give us 3.1 sigma. The reason of Juno is that in 10 years' time, after 10 years, definitely before 20 years, the oscillation landscape would be understood. So at that point, we would already know what the mass order is and what's the next big focus. That would be the neutrinos stability. So one proposal to upgrade the general experiment is to put a balloon inside the central detector. And this balloon is filled with xenon-loaded neodymium or tellurium. It's not decided yet. But that would be a very interesting follow-up. However, overall, the observatory is designed for the next 30 years. The science exploration includes, but as you already have seen, reactor neutrinos and also neutrinos from the Earth. But in fact, we can also see neutrinos from the sun, from the atmosphere, and from perhaps supernovas. And also, Juno can search for a BSM like the Donald Cannon. So for the solar neutrinos, the quickest way to understand how the measurement can be done is the following. We just satisfies us with the first order accuracy because the theta mark three, you know, is small. We can simply put it as zero because we don't care about the real half flavor. So this solar neutrino basically becomes a perfectly well-defined flavor oscillation. So here it becomes begins. In the center of the sun, the new E is produced. And it is a mixture of the mass one and two. If the neutrino energy is low, the mass one and two propagate as if they're in vacuum. And this vacuum propagation continues to Earth because it is fast space, they have to travel. They don't have coherence anymore, they just add up independently, therefore we have a survival probability of the electron like this. So a number here. However, if we have the high energy neutrinos from the sun, because of the magnetic effect, then most of the neutrinos will be in the V2 state at the surface of sun, and then again it continues to propagate in vacuum to Earth. And in this case, we have survival probability here. But now we have the question. We talk about low energy and high energy, but how high is high? In these two flavor oscillation problem, the only energy scale is delta m squared to 1. Therefore, actually, the energy scale is calculated by this. When you stretch the two limits, we have this outcome. If we can measure this outcome, we can measure this delta m squared to 1. This is the basic idea. So here in general, for different delta m squared to 1, we have different predicted image shape or spectral shape. And you can see it's all in the MU regime. Therefore, if we can measure the boron A solar tunes, this measurement can be done. It's very interesting because in one single experiment, you can measure the same basic quantity, namely the solar mixing parameters from reactors and also from neutrinos from the sun. This will give us direct comparison that relates to magnetic effects or neutrinos versus anti-neutrinos or perhaps BSN. And in addition, we are also sensitive to other solar neutrino species. I mentioned the mechanical energy pop inside the sun, helium. It's very difficult. However, because the solar neutrinos are all neutrinos, not anti-neutrinos, therefore the reaction happens not on the hydrogen, not on the carbon. It can only happen on electron with enough scattering. Of course, there are other small channels at 1% weight that happening, but to the first order, the enough scattering is a major contribution. And without the IPD coincidence, in this case, it's very difficult to select the event. Therefore, we have to control the background to the extreme level. Now, let me come to the end and summarize. So after 13 years of effort, journal is completed and then running, and the whole collaboration is very excited and happy, especially the younger generation, because they can actually play with the data. And the first journal result is using 26 days of data and both producing world-leading results for those solar parameters. And it has demonstrated as a precision reactor neutrino measurement with 20 kiloton neutrinometer as a baseline 50 kilometers. So looking ahead, actually what we have demonstrated is the validation of the detailed performance in terms of the energy and background control. All these key performance have reached the design level, and some of them are actually better than the design. But the critical one, we're still working on, we're working on that, and it's mostly mapped. So in the future, near future, towards the mass ordering, we need high statistics and also optimize in terms of performance. But most importantly, the near detector at the Taishan nuclear power plant has just gone online on February. And when this data is used, we will use this to constrain the neutrino flux and provide the reference spectrum. So instead of using the bed, we actually can have our own near detector constraint. So all in all, it provides a diagnostic solution program for the next 30 years. Thank you.
Thank you again for a very nice overview of the whole experiment. So we have time for questions. Yes.
I was curious about the 3 millimeters of instruction. What's the density of the liquid scintillator, and how much does the detector change when you change from liquid to water to liquid scintillator?
It's lighter than water, therefore, when you see actually filling, we drain down the water and then pump in the liquid scintillator from above. And you raised an important point because there's only maximum one pressure balance point between the water and the scintillator. And then actually, we have tuned it like that. It is always a negative pressure inside the vessel, namely, always is the water pushing inside. That is better for the mechanical integrity of the vessel because it's easier to go against pressure instead of against the implosion from inside. So all this mechanical stress on the acrylic vessel and also the stainless steel structure has been in the calculation and also monitored closely with the pressure sensors.
So I'm just trying to understand, does that mean that you're controlling the pressure such that there was essentially no change? Change on swapping from water to something.
It's a dynamic process. We have to balance point by point. Eventually, it is the balance point below the ground, so there's no balance point. But when we fill it, we do have to change balance point and then see gradually how the whole system reacts. Because it's funny, when you see the strength or the level of the ground actually changes when you fill. So it's really scary. What does it mean? But eventually stabilize and then everything is understood, I would say. So nothing's really planned, but thanks to all these things of monitoring, we do have a gradual understanding of it.
Very impressive.
So you pointed out that there's a tension between data from the sun and reactor neutrons.
This is a solar neutrino problem.
So is there like a future plan schedule for Juno to do that as well and see if you can still see that tension within the same detector?
For this specific for this problem, the reactor part is mostly done. So what you further do with the anti-electron machine from the reactor is to shrink the air box. But then on the other hand, Juno can also measure the solar neutrinos itself. So yeah, to provide the delta M squared to one for solar neutrinos. And hopefully we can also shrink the air box and actually see in one experiment whether we still have this discrepancy. Any questions from Zoom?
Yeah, any questions from Zoom?
Next.
So you have mentioned the possibility of supernova, obviously, is something you want to optimize for. How much does that influence the DAQ?
We have a dedicated trigger on that. So, it doesn't affect the current landscape, it's still running, but then I don't see a contradiction in that. So,
may I ask how this data-taking days are counted, and what is the downtime for what's the lifetime of the detector?
So First of all, we exclude all those tests or bad data, and then we also have the data code calibration runs. They are also excluded, so the remaining time is one. And then we also have the DQ time defined as the physics pass calibration. Yeah, so this is how all those periods are added together and then counted toward the 59 common days.
Nice.
Yeah, the uptime is quite high, about 97 weeks.
Yeah, so. Oh, yeah, you can see it then.
On slide 15, sorry, I have I always have a hard time understanding this plot. So you have oscillation length on the right, the energy, and then EV. I mean, can you please explain this a bit, how this is the structure of this diagram?
Okay, so this is the energy of the neutrino they use. And that is how far the neutrino travel from the source to the detector.
That's the distance of
travel. Okay. Yeah, this is the baseline. Yeah, and then corresponding, you put the experiment onto it.
So the left side DV is the.
It's the converted. HBAR-C becomes one, I would say. With this natural unit, you just convert the L from energy, from the length to the energy.
Okay. And if you then the Juno part is the mainly the yellow one.
Juno is specific here. The baseline is 1.52 kilometers. So it's here, and then the energy will cost several from 0.1 MeV to 10 MeV. So there's an extension in this domain. But then the baseline is rather small.
It's between those two. Black lines.
No. The other black line is the random. It's another experiment.
Ah, okay.
So for Juno, it's only this line.
Okay.
By the way, random is in, does not exist anymore. This plot is in 2020, so it's probably outdated.
Okay.
Now, this we are only talking about Kamna and Juno, but then Snow Plus recently also had presented solar mixing. Result from reactor, which you know, so so us also sitting here.
Sorry, it reminded me of something else you mentioned this early on, that if there were only two neutrino species and there was no concept of normal or inverted ordering.
Yep.
I was sort of curious about that. I mean, I would sort of imagine it may could make a difference to things whether the heavier neutrino is mostly electron or mostly muon, if those are the two species only.
It depends how you define things. What is the order you define things, right? So you can always define one as the lightest one.
Mm-hmm.
And heavy is this two. Sure. And in this case, you just observe what is composition of the different flavors to one and to two. That's all. Right? So the essence of the three flavor or hierarchy or order is that it's really the
I understand the definition with three. I'm just sort of not sure that it follows that with two it's not an interesting question. Wait, I mean obviously you just have to measure the fractions, but
yeah, you make a good point. What happens if the two actually is dominated by the electron? Yeah, would you call it a mass ordering? Well, depends.
Fine.
Can I ask for your projection for the 7-year measurement?
Mm-hmm.
Whether that is impacted by the number of accelerators around, or and whether adding a newer accelerator would reduce, or how that period could be reduced?
This First of all, is statistics from the vectors and also the detector performance. And you remember, in order to tease out the information of the mass ordering, we have to see the ripples of the spectrum. That requires superb energy resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the current projection is based on 3.1%. And we are observing 3.4%. So still some work to do, and that actually limits our day. On the other hand, we also need to understand that an oscillating spectrum very well. And this is where the tau detector comes in. Mm-hmm. So with the tau and better calibration, we could achieve this 7.1 years or maybe reduce really depends on the performance for the improvement.
Yeah, I think this is really exciting point about the journal Fermat. And just a comment, I think it's really impressive for such a short time since the collection of data started.
Yeah, for some people,
and the
it's
first
not short
result.
Enough.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But yes, I guess everyone is curious about the results.
Stay tuned.
Yes.
I was also curious. I mean, the end, you showed the picture, the whole thing is covered in the sort of some white material. What is that?
One of the photographs, the
in,
detector.
Like, for example, in the 41, slide 41.
Looked white.
Yeah. So, what's this material which this is covering? The whole
the cover. First of all, this is the high density polyethylene, and this is the tyvek. They all are refractive, so to improve the optical separation between different parts. And also, this one can shield from the shield the radioactivity, stop the material coming from inside because the wall is dirty. Tyvek is a funny material, it's actually a brand.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then it's been used in basically many neutrinos experiments to do the optical separation.
Do you know where it is produced?
I know people buy it from China. And where are other places? I don't know.
Okay.
It's common material, actually.
I think I've seen it in construction.
Which construction?
Like buildings.
Oh, no, it's different.
No, it's different.
Because I would say this Tyvek is have some specs that is beyond some construction. For construction, it's just shielded dust, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's more than that.
Oh, it's, cool. Okay.
Because it has to be immersed in liquid.
Yes. Okay, let's thank Chan. And we close the seminar here and also thank
lunch,
you very much.
Anybody wants to join?
Please join for lunch with us and take some cookies with you.